So, hi everyone. My name is Sergey. I will be moderator of next speech. Its speaker is Bill Barr. And speech name is Willingness for. So, I give the microphone to Bill. Yes, I read the disclaimer. We want everyone to feel safe. We understand you may be feeling suicidal, or you may be having suicidal thoughts, and we are here to support you. However, we are non-professional two-step recovery groups, 12-step recovery groups, and are not qualified to provide professional help. If you are in the danger of harming yourself or others, or perhaps attempting suicide, we encourage you to leave the meeting and immediately call the emergency number in your area, or go to the nearest local hospital emergency room. This kind of call will be recorded. An audio-only version of the recording will be made available on the Depressed Anonymous website. During the speaker's share, a moderator will be ensuring that everyone else's microphone remains mute. In time permits, there will be a question and answer session after the speaker finishes. You can unmute your microphone at that time and ask your question. If you do not wish to be recorded, please ask your question in the chat box, and the moderator will ask the speaker. Please do not share identifying information. Anything said here today is the opinion of the speaker and does not represent the opinion of the Fellowship of Depressed Anonymous, nor Depressed Anonymous publication. All statements are for informational purposes only and not imply any guarantee of results. Any copyright material shared by speaker is done so under the fair use doctrine, and the original copyright holder maintains full ownership of the material. Okay, welcome, Bill. Let's your speech.
Thank you, Sergey. Thank you for introducing me. I appreciate it. I'm Bill. I'm recovering from depression, and I'm powerless over a lot of things, not just depression. And I say that because I can medicate with many different things. There are many drugs of choice that I can pick from, including depression, food, alcohol, TV, computer games, isolation. Those are all drugs in my drug box, and I can choose to use them or not. But anyway. I'm one of seven kids. I was the only boy, and no, I was not spoiled. And I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home, but I'm a grandchild of alcoholics on both sides. So I didn't experience the high-level drama of an active alcoholic, but I did experience the low-level drama of family secrets, don't share your feelings, everything is fine, don't let people know. And, you know, it affected me. And I learned early on to escape. And my form of escape usually involved fantasy, television, comic books, or imaginary play. And I got very good at it. And what I would do, as I would isolate myself, because isolation does have a short-term benefit. And that benefit is that I'm not going to get hurt emotionally in that moment. If I isolate and pull away, you know, I'm getting something out of it. But it has a long-term consequence that I can't grow relationships. My family and my wife and my friends will feel neglected, and that's not where I want to go. And sadness has always been part of my life. And in AA, they talk about there's a point in time that you cross the imaginary line from safe drinking to alcoholism. And I don't know when I crossed that line from sadness to depression. But sadness has always been part of my life. I can't remember a time without having an overall sense of sadness to me. And my best thinking got me hospitalized multiple times for depression. Thankfully, they were all done of my own volition, and I checked myself in. But if I hadn't done that, it very easily could have gone to being, you know, checked in with, against my will. And the way my depression manifests, I've had suicidal ideation a little bit in my life, but that's not my go-to. My go-to is I become a deer in the headlights. I just can't get anything done, and I isolate. That's how my depression looks. And what I had to do was I had to learn to be willing to admit that my best thinking got me to this state of depression. And the way out is to involve others. You know, other people, God, therapists, psychiatrists, it runs the gamut. And, you know, that's step one in a nutshell. Admitting that I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable. And my thinking got me to that place. And I bottomed out in another addiction in December of 2002, and I immediately started doing therapy, group and individual therapy, and I started on a course of medications, and I've been on medications for 18 years now. And I was in a group therapy session, and my counselor said, "Bill, you're using a lot of words and phrases that alcoholics use. You may want to go to an AA meeting and check it out." So I did, and I was at home. And I started to go to AA a lot. My heavy addictive drinking was done mostly in my teens and my 20s, but I definitely did drink alcoholically when I was actively using alcohol. And I fit right in, and the 12 steps became part of my life. And they are a guiding principle. And I started working the steps on my own. Not recommended. It is recommended you include other people and God. But I started doing it on my own. And I had to be willing to admit my shortcomings. And that's really step four, is taking a moral inventory of myself. And what I found when doing that, and in multiple times in my life, if I'm vague about something, it's a trap. Because for me, if it's vague, I can obsess about it. It's too big of a problem to handle. I'll avoid it. And I'll just be on the mental gerbil wheel. So I have to be very specific, because when I'm specific, I have a chance at addressing the problem. Like, if I'm angry at somebody, I can't just be, I'm angry at them, I have a resentment. I have to be very specific. What action or statement did they make that pisses me off? Because when I'm specific, it lessens the intensity of the anger. And also, by identifying it specifically, it creates a small space for compassion to grow. Compassion for the other person and compassion for me. And one way I get to that place of compassion is by asking myself the question, how am I guilty of the same or similar crime that I'm accusing the other person of? Because there's a slogan in recovery and self-help: if you spot it, you got it. If you are pissed off about something in somebody else, it's because you're, well, when I'm pissed off at other people, I'll speak for myself. When I'm angry at somebody else, I'm angry because I see my character defects manifest in them. And, you know, I had to become willing to admit my shortcomings. And then step five is I have to share it with somebody else and share it with God. And some people think that courage is standing in the face of a wolf or a tiger and fighting them off. That's not courage. Courage is being willing to be vulnerable and to share your brokenness with another person. And I had to learn humility, to be vulnerable, to share that with another. I think it was Mother Teresa, true courage is being willing to be vulnerable, or something like that. And if you're looking for a pathway to connect with other people, loved ones, children, spouse, friends, the pathway to a good relationship is humility and being willing to share your brokenness, your flawed aspects with another person. Now, I wouldn't recommend you share them with your mortal enemy, but the people that you love, it's very important for me to do that. And if you look at the seven deadly sins, the first of the seven deadly sins is pride. And in my opinion, pride's not the problem. The problem is false pride. You know, if I work my butt off and exercise and I win a race, I should be proud of my accomplishment. That's true pride. False pride comes in two forms. The first is positive self-pride, thinking that I'm better than everybody else. And the second is negative self-pride, negative pride, that I am worse than everybody else. And neither one of those are true. I'm just another person. You know, I may be different than you, but that doesn't make me better than you. That just makes me different. And I learned a simple prayer in the rooms to get closer to humility. And this is the whole prayer. One sentence, Lord, may I see myself as you see me. That's it. And I started to say that regularly. Lord, may I see myself as you see me. Because my vision is distorted. There's stuff in literature and movies and media that talks about having rose-colored glasses. That's not me. I'm crap-colored glasses. You know, I see the world through the vision of pain and fear, and I have to learn to see it in God's eyes. I have to have a sense of wonder about the universe, about myself, and I get in touch with that by being humble. And in my path of recovery, there were people that were toxic to me, that were triggering. And when I was around them, I would fall into bad behavior. I would say something that I would regret. So I found I had to limit my exposure to those toxic people. And I did that by defining mature, serene boundaries. And boundaries are not about controlling the other person. Boundaries are about protecting that inner wounded child. You know, what's acceptable? And, you know, a bad boundary would be, don't get angry at me. That's not realistic. God gave us emotions for a reason. And anger is a real thing, and it should be experienced. You shouldn't act from that place of anger, but anger is there for a reason. But a better form of a boundary is something along the lines of, when you raise your voice in anger to me, I feel scared, and I need you to stop raising your voice in anger to me. And if you continue to raise your voice in anger to me, I'm going to go for a 15-minute walk. And we'll talk about it when I get back. I'm taking little Bill, that wounded child within, away from the toxic situation. Because it's not healthy for him. I'm parenting my inner wounded child. And that's what we all need to do. And for me, at the beginning of recovery, I couldn't be in close contact with my parents. I couldn't hear their voice. I couldn't see them face to face. It was just too triggering for me. So I relied on letters, the real handwritten kind, and emails. My parents are not particularly good at email, so it was more letters than email. And eventually I got strong enough where I could interact with them. So the thing is, you need to set boundaries with toxic people. And, you know, maybe they need to be avoided altogether. But the trick is, you still need to love them. Not as a romantic partner, not as a parent, not as a child. You need to love them as a human being. You know, that person may be so toxic that you can't have them around in your life. Okay, protect yourself. Protect that inner wounded child. But you still need to have a small piece of you love that other person as a human being. And so I needed to be willing to avoid toxic people while still be willing to love them from afar. So the net-net is, don't cut people out of your life completely. Just set up clean boundaries. And the next thing that I had to do in recovery, they talk in AA a lot about stinking thinking, that veil of negativity that takes us over. And by my nature, I'm an extremely critical person. I can find fault with perfection. Buddha's fat, Gandhi walks around half naked, and Jesus needs a haircut. That's the level of criticism I can fall into. So I picked up in my travels recovery and Buddhism, and I realized I had to start asking myself four questions before I spoke. Is it true? Is it kind? Is it necessary? And is it humble? And if the answer was no to any of those questions, I had to keep my mouth shut. I just couldn't speak because I was transgressing the four questions. And where I would fall into a trap before recovery is what I thought was more often than not true, but it wasn't kind, it wasn't necessary, and it wasn't humble. And I'll give you an example. Most people are poor spellers and grammarians. They have poor spelling and grammar. It's a fact. But it's not my job. It's not necessary for me to say anything. It's really not. But if you, as my friend, ask for feedback on your cover letter and resume, it now becomes necessary. I need to respond, but I need to do so kindly and humbly. I can't, you know, the brutal truth is just that. It's brutal. That you have to be kind, and it has to be necessary. So I started doing this for several weeks, and the amount of criticism that was coming out of my mouth diminished quite a bit. And I had this personal epiphany. Oprah Winfrey calls it an aha moment. And I heard an author refer to it once as the blinding flash of the obvious of holy crap. So I had one of those moments of, holy crap, I need to start applying these questions to my thoughts. Because my thoughts weren't true, they weren't kind, they weren't necessary, and they weren't humble. And you know, I started to apply those to my thoughts, and I started to change. And words have great power. Choose them wisely. And one form of not choosing words wisely is over-dramatizing things. Saying it was the worst thing that happened to me. Really? That's the worst thing that ever happened to you? My guess is it wasn't good, but it probably was not the worst thing that ever happened to you. So I try to be very true and right-sized in my thoughts and in my words because they have great power. And I'm going to internalize that on a subconscious level. I have to let that poor habit, I have to let it go. And Stacy mentioned it in her talk, and it's a real belief of mine. My greatest weakness when it comes to depression is I'm powerless over my first thought. My first thought, more often than not, is dark, depressive, critical, negative. That's just where my brain goes. And I used to judge myself. I used to say, I shouldn't have those thoughts. I shouldn't have those feelings. Well, I do. That's the first thought that comes to mind. Okay, big deal. What am I going to do with it? So as someone with depression, I can't be held responsible for that first thought. Okay, accept that. But as someone in recovery from depression, I'm responsible for my second thought and my first action. What am I choosing to focus on? Am I focusing on gratitude? Am I focusing on acting and being of service to others? Those are things that I'm responsible for. You know, maybe the crazy voice in my head is saying to act out like a petulant child. But that's not going to get me anywhere. That's not going to be healthy for that inner wounded child. I need to do what's healthy. I need to be an example for that wounded inner child. And so that's the next lesson around willingness. Willingness to forgive myself and my first negative thought. And I'm sure all of you, most of you, fall into that trap as well. Let the judgment go about the first thought. It's your first thought. Okay. Focus on the second thought and the first action. And one thing that's mentioned as a trap in Alcoholics Anonymous is a phrase, contempt prior to investigation. To say something doesn't work, it'll never work before I try it. I have to give it an honest try. Because if I don't give it that honest try, it's definitely not going to work. So I mentioned before that I had this long-standing resentment. I mentioned before my parents were toxic to me. I harbored a long-standing resentment towards my parents. They wronged me. It doesn't matter what the thing is they did, but they did something that hurt me deeply. And I held on to it for years, about 15 years. And it was eating me up on the inside. And I was speaking to my sponsor in AA, and he said, Bill, you need to pray for your parents. And the first thought that was in my head was, no freaking way am I going to pray for my parents. But then what came to me was the small, still voice of my higher power. The small, still voice of recovery that asked me, well, Bill, what are you willing to do? And I realized I was willing to pray for the willingness. So I prayed for the willingness for 2 weeks, and the willingness came. And then I prayed for 2 weeks for my parents, that they know peace, that they know love, that they feel the contact of their higher power. And after 2 weeks of praying that every day, the resentment was gone. You know, the bile in the back of my throat, the seething anger, wasn't there anymore. The scar was still there. They hurt me. But it was no longer a festering wound. It had healed over. And if you want a written example of that, page 552, or maybe it's 553, of the fourth edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's right there. And I just missed it when I read it before. It's right there. they showed me the path, but I was ignorant to it. So I had to stumble upon it myself. I was asked to forgive and pray for someone. And the small voice of recovery asked me what I was willing to do. So what it boils down to, the lesson here, is I needed to be willing to take suggestions from others. Suggestions from my higher power, that small, still voice. Suggestions from the people I love and trust. Suggestions from my sponsor. Even though my initial thought that may come to mind is no, never, I would suggest you alter that language slightly and instead say, no, not right now. Be open to the possibility in the future that you're going to follow that suggestion, that you're going to do what's suggested to you. You may not be in a place where you're strong enough or ready to take that suggestion, but be open to the possibility. You know, at the beginning of my recovery journey, I was very resistant to taking medication. This was after like the first session of group therapy in a psychiatrist's office. And I was resistant, and the psychiatrist came back and he told a little story, little analogy. He said, imagine a large tree has fallen in your backyard, and you are responsible for getting rid of the tree. You can't hire someone. It has to be you. Now, you can take a handsaw and cut the tree apart, or you can use a chainsaw and cut the tree apart, but you still need to move the wood. Which would you choose? The chainsaw. Well, the chainsaw is medication. It doesn't take away the need for me to do the work and haul the wood away. It just makes it easier to cut through it. It gives me the strength and the fortitude to maybe come back up to normal. I still have the inclination of dark, depressive thoughts, but it helps. In the last talk, Stacy was talking about her emotions were a sine wave and her bottom was being suicidal. I wasn't quite to that degree, but I was pretty low. And a normal person fluctuates around here. My norm was down here. So what medication does is it brings up my sine wave. It never brought me to zero. I'm still below what a normal person, what their normal person level is, but I'm better than I was without medication. And on the subject of medication, I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on TV. I can't recommend a particular medication to you, but I can say from the bottom of my heart, if you get on medication and you want to get off medication, if you're old enough and mature enough to say, I want to get off medication, for God's sake, you're old enough and mature enough to talk to your doctor about it. Because I didn't talk to my doctor, and I fell into a deep, deep depression. Take the advice of medical professionals. They know the medicine. They may not know you and your depression, but they know the medicine. And they know the side effects. So, you know, if you decide not to take medicine, great. If you decide to take medicine, great. If you decide to get off medicine, great. If and only if you talk to the doctor before you do it. So that's me on my soapbox. Forgive me for ranting there. And so the lesson is willingness to take suggestions from other people and trying it on for size. You know, it may work, it may not. I have a list of over 100 things that I could do to treat my depression. And some of those are options I choose not to take. But some are options I am willing to take. And it's up to me to decide what's good for me, with advice from my loved ones and my doctor. There are things I can do. And a big one, the one that's probably helped me the most, is recovery. Applying the spiritual principles of the 12 steps, using it as a framework for life. You know, willing to admit when I'm wrong and promptly admit it, step 10. And the funny thing is, step 10 is continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admit it. Now, the sticky wicket, the sticky word in that statement is promptly. The longer I'm in recovery, the more prompt becomes. I'm more willing, the further I'm into recovery, to admit my faults, and more willing to admit them to another person. So if you're not at the place where you can admit right away, it doesn't matter. Start the journey. Start the journey. You know, if I choose to not admit my fault to another when I do it, I'm just building an opportunity for me to need to do a future ninth step. You know, it's hard to do the ninth step. It's meant to be hard, but you grow from it. And I would prefer not to have to do another ninth step about a new flaw that I've created in myself. If I do it right away, you know, if I catch it right away and admit my fault, it's not a big deal. You know, I catch the snowball at the top of the hill when it's a little tiny snowball. If I try to catch it at the bottom of the hill when it's this monster snowball, I'm going to have a really hard time stopping it if I can. So if I make a mistake, I need to admit as promptly as I can that I messed up, so I don't create a new ninth step that I have to do. So in case you haven't figured out, the topic of this talk is willingness. I need to be willing to do things, or at least pray for the willingness to do things, because willingness is the key. It's the thing that unlocks the gate. And I want to get through to peace and serenity and contentness and happiness, but I'm locked behind a gate. And I have to be willing to put the work in, to open the lock. I still need to walk through the gate. I still need to do the work. But willingness is the key. It opens the lock. I can begin the process of moving forward. And some people say, in AA, don't drink and go to meetings, and that's all they do. So the equivalent of that in DA would be read the literature and go to meetings. That's not enough. That's going to create the depressed equivalent of a dry drunk. I need to do the work. I need to follow the questions in the workbook and put the effort in and write out my answers and to share it with somebody else. That's the work of recovery from depression. Being willing to do the work. Does it suck? Yes, it does. It's painful. It brings up things I don't want to talk about. But there is no growth without pain. Let me repeat that. There is no growth without pain. One big problem with astronauts when they stay in space for too long, their bones atrophy. The calcium leaches out of them. Why? Well, here on Earth, where we have gravity, it puts a constant strain on our bones, and it creates little tiny micro damage within the bone, and then the bone heals itself back up again. And we're doing that with our psyche. We need to start picking away at that big problem, that big knot of yarn in my head, and start picking away at it so I can heal. And I have to be willing to go through short-term pain to achieve long-term gain and growth. You know, do I still fall back on bad behavior? Yeah, I'm depressive and I'm an addict and my first thought is a bad one. And I just need to let that go. Oh, and I talked about willingness to change my speech before. I'd like to just revisit that for a moment. I grew up a Catholic, and I still go to Mass. I'm not pushing that on anybody else, but that's my background. And a lot of my language uses Christian words, but I'm not big on doctrine. You believe what you want to believe. But I was stuck on the words good and bad. They had significant emotional baggage associated with them. And because when I think bad, I think horribly bad, going to hell bad. And I would get stuck on that. And I learned different words from Buddhism. Helpful and unhelpful. Helpful things are those thoughts or actions that decrease suffering in myself and others. Unskillful or unhelpful are things that create suffering in myself or others. So changing my language from good and bad to helpful and unhelpful, or skillful and unskillful, helped me tremendously. Because those words, skillful and unskillful, they don't have baggage. I can use them. So if you have certain words in your heritage that have baggage, pick a different word. That's what's great about it. Words have so many, languages have so many words. We can pick and choose what we want to use. And some people in DA, in the rooms of recovery, take real issue with the word God, because they've been wounded by people who say they follow God. And let me give you a little analogy. Let's say you're trying to describe the furnishings and layout of a house, but you can't use the word couch, sofa, chair, rug, table. You can't use those words. You have to start getting real wordy to describe this rectangular horizontal surface with legs that could fall to the floor, and you use it for things like eating on. That's a table. But that took a lot of words to say table. God is just a shorthand. It's just a shorthand for the higher power, for things that are too big for a small human mind to comprehend and express. You know, I think of the higher power as this multifaceted diamond, and we're all looking at the diamond from a different facet. We're all looking at the same thing. We're just seeing it differently. Let go of someone else's words. They're just words. And if you're looking for a scriptural reference, look for the Buddhist parable about the four blind men describing an elephant. It sums it up nicely that, you know, one feels something sharp and hard, and those are the tusks. Another person feels something large and heavy like a tree, that's the leg. Someone feels something long and flexible and kind of icky, that's the trunk. And someone feels a stick with like a bush at the end, that's the tail. They're all describing the elephant, but they can't see the whole picture. That's what we are. We are blind people trying to look at God. We can't. It's beyond our ability. We have to use simple words to describe the complex. Let go of the word. It's just a word. So I have to be willing to let go of words that have baggage for me. I just do. And I'm coming towards the end of my time. And I just wanted to talk really about one more topic. It's about the dread of, oh my God, I'm going to be in recovery for the rest of my life. Oh my God, I can't drink for the rest of my life. Whatever your drug of choice is, you know, oh God, I'm not going to be able to do this thing. I don't need to be sober and serene and sane forever. I only need to be sober and serene and happy today. I don't need to be loving and kind forever. I just need to be loving and kind today. It's not about forever. It's about right here, right now. The present moment is where God is. I'll say something from Christian scripture. In Psalms 46:10, it says, "Be still and know that I am God." Not I was God, not I will be God. When I think about yesterday and tomorrow, think about my worries and my anxieties, life sucks. But when I stay in the moment, the right here, right now, and experience it fully, life is good. I'm in a room talking to friends. Some of those friends are strangers. Some are stranger than others. But my life is good right now because I'm in the present moment. And that's where God is, or whatever you choose God to be. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity and honor to share my story. And I'll end it here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bill, for an impressive speech. And it's time, and I'll follow up a format for good questions to speaker. It's better gift to speaker is answering him questions. Okay, so just put the microphone on and answer the question. If you don't want your voice to be recorded, just put in the chat box and I will read it to Bill. Okay. Questions, ladies and gentlemen.
Hi, Bill. This is Mara, recovering from depression.
Hi, Mara.
I have to say, Bill, that that was an excellent, excellent reflection on your part. I always learn from you. You are an excellent teacher. And as I said, I've learned so much from you, and I am so grateful to be in this fellowship with you. And just thank you. Thank you for helping me in my recovery journey and for continuing to help me in my depression, recovering from depression. So, Bill, just thank you.
You're most welcome. And thank you for sharing your story when we're in meetings. I have one more thing to be willing to do. You need to be willing to let go of the phrase, "I suffer from depression." Because guess what? When I say I suffer from depression, I suffer from depression. Change your language. I'm recovering from depression. Thanks.
I am Sheila, and I am recovering from depression.
Awesome.
You know, Bill, I've been sitting through a series of speakers this morning, as some of us have been, right?
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank you for something profoundly. When I was asked to go to a meeting when I was on my first bottom, right, and I didn't know what a meeting was, and I said yes, right? because I was willing and desperate. 22 years old, and I'm 72. And so this spring, when I had the willingness to ask for the help I needed for the depression I had hit, there it was. I am willing. I want to get better. And I thank you so much for part of what you shared in that arena. So see you later in a meeting somewhere, dude. Okay?
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
You're most welcome.
Any more question or reflection? Welcome. Okay, so if nobody wants, up to the moment, I have some question. My name is Eri. I'm recovering from depression. Severe. Yes, but I'm often wanna go back to my values, old values. I was living 44 years using this old system. It brings me to suicide. But I sometimes have this wish to go back, and I do that. So then I go to the deep end, and I remember about new values, and I'm recovering. So how do you solve that problem? So not to go to the deep end before to start using the 12-step values. Thanks.
Thank you for asking me the question, Sergey. The way I got it was, how do you prevent falling back on bad behavior and going, the dark route? And one thing that helps me a lot is recognizing that I have a choice. I could go my old way. That is something I can choose to do, but I choose not to. And the other thing that's really helpful is the analogy of the snowball. That a snowball is rolling down the hill. It starts at the top, picks up speed, picks up more snow, and becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And at the bottom of the hill is a lake. And if it falls into the lake, that's that dark, depressive hole. That's the bottom line if you're addicted to a substance. Of using again. The trick is to catch the snowball sooner on the hill. To work towards progress. Catching the snowball further up the hill each time. And if you make a mistake, okay, you made a mistake. Brush yourself off. Do what you need to do. And try again. Short of death, there is no such thing as failure. It's only feedback. What you didn't work out. It's not failure. You just know a way not to do it again in the future. And let go of the judgment. I'm very judgmental of myself, so I've really have, and I still struggle with judgment. But I have to start the process somewhere. And I think that's all I can share on the topic.
Okay, thank you very much. So I never miss the slogan. Yes, catch the snowball. And so I will put it into my library. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, some more question on perfection. You?
Hi, I'm Julian, calling from Paris, recovering from depression.
Hi, Julian. Bonjour.
Bonjour. I have a question. I like what you said about go to meetings and read literature because it's what I did. I joined the fellowship at the start of the lockdown, And that's what I did. But and I had seen some improvement, but now I feel again depressed, even suicidal, even if I will not commit suicide. It's just, you know, thoughts. It's just passive ideation. And I'm a believer, so I will not commit suicide. But I think, and I know it's related to my depression mindset. But the question was, I haven't worked the workbook, and I heard that you were talking about the workbook. So do I need to start writing step one on my own without a sponsor, or do I need to find first a sponsor and then start writing with the workbook? I don't know. And honestly, I didn't. I just asked in the DA chat group if anyone was available. One person responded, but I don't know if it's available. But I think I will keep asking to people. That's my question. It's a bit. Yes.
One thing is, if you haven't bought the workbook, I would suggest buying it and working through the questions and answering them. But it sounds like you did that. My concern is you did it yourself. That's good that you did it, but the real task is sharing it with another person. Having the courage to be vulnerable and discuss it with somebody else. You know, it could be a sponsor, it could be a priest, it could be a Buddhist monk. Find somebody that you can share it with. We're not meant to do this alone. The first word of the first step is we. Doing it alone is crazy. Recovery is a team sport.
Thank you, Bill.
You're welcome, Julian.
Questions, reflections, something with you. We have 8 minutes left. Any question? Okay, so if there is any questions, I said moderator, I think I did whatever I could. Yes.
Thank you for your service, Sergey.
Both people asking the questions. Thank you very much again for the last, not least, speech. In a couple of minutes, there will be party time. So, pancakes, lemonade, cakes, and some snacks. So, I'm last moderator, so, and probably I might say so. Congratulations, ladies and gentlemen. We did it. Yes, we did that conference. I stop recording.